Hello. Okay, we will bring the June 17th special meeting of the City Council to order. And this is a special meeting, so we're going to have, there was some confusion about when the meeting started. We're going to have two public comment periods. We're going to have one now, and then we're going to have a presentation. And then at 6 o'clock, we will have another public comment. And if you learn something in the presentation, you want to have another comment later, you can do that too. That's fine. We want to make sure everybody has a chance to say whatever they want to say on the subject. But on this subject, nothing else. It's a special meeting, so it's just about redevelopment. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Rambo.
Thank you, Madam Mayor and Council. My hand?
Go ahead.
Okay. So.
Do you flip the button towards you?
Is that working?
Beautiful.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Madam Mayor and Council. I just thought it might be helpful to give you a little background on how we got here. You may recall through several subsequent preceding council actions, the council.
I'm sorry, you know what? I said we were going to have public comment first, and then I didn't give public comment.
Oh.
So we probably should do that before you start, because you're going to introduce the topic. So we'll have public comment right now for anybody that wants to speak ahead of the game.
Hi, Dave Nelson, Morro Bay. I'm glad to be here tonight. I hope to figure something out about this. I'm ground zero on this. I see the maps, and I hope that it's something that we can inform the public about a little bit better than what happened here tonight. It was kind of scary with all your notices, to be honest. But, you know, I hope that we go from ground zero and let us know why we should pay more.
Waited, apparently. That's why my glasses are dark and my hair is flying. Left the front garden to come down here and help you hardworking stiffs. First of all, as to redevelopment, you know that I favored this a long time ago, and so I'd say go ahead, please do it. And I'd also say that I definitely favor including the power plant. Some of the things that I would cite here is, and having read parts of the report, I actually took a read at some of the parts of the report, I'd say that the valuation has really bottomed on that property. It can only go up from right now. If the consultant is looking at site use issues, those have been resolved in part by the hard work of the new Futures Committee. We've cited brownfield monies that can be available to any developer. We've cited the lease issues that are existent there, but in a redevelopment agency, those could be helped. I think that it could be used as a taxable reuse, too. I think they also cite that you should be careful that the power plant property not simply go to some walking park or things like that, but that it go to alternative energy generation or a hotel or aquatic theme park, anything. Also, they were projecting into 45 years at the end of the report, and I think you can't actually project 45 years into the future when you're using very conservative numbers, which I know as consultants they have to use these very conservative numbers. But you can't look 45 years into the future when at the beginning of the book they say that they can't exert too high a level of speculation. But I think on that flat coastal land that looks at one of the most beautiful scenic resources on the Central Coast, i.e. the opening of Morro Bay Harbor, that you cannot have a high enough level of speculation as to what that could do down there and how that could benefit this city. Also, I would wonder openly, and I would hope you would ask the consultant, why they didn't include the downtown Morro Bay district. For years, again, as a council person, I was asking, why not have some downtown visioning? Well, why not put them into this redevelopment thing? I was being shown a picture of my old house when it was down there where the Bank of America is now, and you can see in that picture from 1910 buildings that are still existent on Morro Bay Boulevard. Sooner or later, people are going to come in, and they've already come before this council several years ago wanting to build new buildings down there, mixed use. Janice, you are in favor of mixed use development down there. So when they do this, I would rather have it inside a redevelopment agency so that the city can gain some of the benefits for that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else?
Hi, Futures Report, and if not, will it?
I'm going to ask that. Okay, anyone else? All right, we'll close the public comment. And now, Bruce, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Madam Mayor. Yeah, just in terms of the background, this project was entirely grant-funded. You may recall a portion of it was funded with Community Development Block Grant planning and technical assistance grants, and the remaining balance of that was funded from previous community development, the loan repayment fund. So no general fund revenues were expended on this feasibility study. Actually, Urban Futures was here in 2005 that did a similar presentation about some of the basics of redevelopment. So they've had quite a bit of history with our community and in the area doing redevelopment along the Central Coast. And before, one of the other things that we'd like to identify in here, in addition to that, is that this was identified in the management partner study that you recently reviewed and approved, and redevelopment and the implementation of redevelopment agency was one of the six major goals identified in that study. And actually, in your goal setting workshop in August of 2008, the formation of redevelopment agency was identified as one of your six priorities. So we are consistently following through with your direction on pursuing your priorities. Tonight, I think, in the presentation, I think, as the mayor indicated, I think it'd be helpful maybe just to let the Urban Futures do their presentation. They've got a PowerPoint presentation. I'm not quite sure how long it is, but maybe we can do that. And then questions and answers from the council. And then any, just in a workshop format, just any general questions or comments or suggestions that we may be able to provide what might be helpful. We've got the team of experts here to help us along. I think probably the most important thing that we're recommending here is to seriously consider the findings and conclusions and opinions of the feasibility study. One of the, and we're recommending that we continue this, as the mayor indicated, to July 13th at another public hearing, and we can continue doing that. Tonight's meeting is really just a workshop to present the findings of the study. But one of the key things that we're really going to have to struggle with, as many of you have identified, is whether or not to include the power plant, because as you may have. But at this time, I'll introduce the consultant team then. We've got John Huffman from Urban Futures. John was part of the team that was here in 2005. Doug Anderson from Urban Futures. He does a lot of their financing. And then we've got Alonzo Pedrine from Alfred Gobar Associates that did the economic analysis. So I think at this point, John, maybe it'd be helpful to turn it over to you and then see if the council has any questions, and we'll follow your presentation.
Thank you. Can I be heard? Good. Does the council have questions at this point before we start?
Probably after.
All right. Okay. Doug and Alonzo and I are very happy to be here to make this presentation to the Morro Bay City Council and staff and members of the community. I understand that we're also on TV tonight, so I hope my hair is done. So we have a PowerPoint, as Bruce said. Feel free to watch the screen as we move forward. As Bruce said, we have been here before. As it was in 2005, Richard Tilburg and I were here, and we were asked to come and make a brief presentation as to what redevelopment was about. And I don't remember if all of you were there or some of you were there at the time, but we did that, and I think that was part of the genesis for continuing with the process and looking at the possibility through a feasibility study as to what the benefits, the obligations, the opportunities and constraints of redevelopment in the city of Morro Bay on a more official note would entail. So we were commissioned along with AGA to prepare this feasibility study. We're not new to the Central Coast. As the little time frame shows there, I guess our first experience as a firm was back in Arroyo Grande in 1997. We conducted a redevelopment feasibility study for them. They went on to create a redevelopment project area back in 97, and they have been implementing that project since that point in time. We've worked with the city of Pismo Beach both in 1999 and 2008. While we did not work with them to create a redevelopment project area, we have done implementation work for them, and we have done a feasibility redevelopment feasibility opinion for them, which is a very truncated version of a redevelopment feasibility study. City of San Luis Obispo, back in 1998, we worked with the city to prepare a redevelopment feasibility study. And that particular city at that point in time determined that they were not going to move forward with redevelopment. Move forward with creating an additional redevelopment project area working with Urban Futures. And in 2008, we have done implementation planning work for them. So that's a little bit of our history in the Central Coast. Now, the next part of our program is a redevelopment primer. We know we've talked to at least one person in the audience and said, please, let's start from the beginning. And we know the council probably wants to have an understanding of the foundation of redevelopment before we get into the more of the specifics of the study. So let's talk about California redevelopment powers. Number one is that a redevelopment agency causes the redistribution of property tax dollars. Doesn't have to, but most redevelopment agencies choose to have that as a part of their redevelopment strategy. So you will, in fact, become a de facto taxing entity. You will share, for a period of 45 years under current law, a distribution or a portion of the general property tax levy upon properties within a redevelopment project area. You will, because you have an income stream from tax increment, you will be able to borrow against that income stream, which allows you to pool an amount of money up front. You pledge your tax increment to pay the loans off. You have an amount of money to do things early in the process and get economic development and other aspects of redevelopment going to at an early start, rather than paying as you go, accumulating money much like we do when we're at home and hoping we have enough money to pay for whatever we want to pay for. Most of us, we always want to borrow if we can. There's good debt, bad debt. This would be classified as good debt. Get the money, do the projects and programs, and then create good things that, again, generate additional tax increment, additional growth in the local economy. So you can borrow against your tax increment. It also, redevelopment powers authorize you as a redevelopment agency to acquire and dispose of real property. You, in effect, with regards to these kinds of activities, are a business arm of the city of Morro Bay. With respect to contaminated properties, redevelopment law allows redevelopment agencies unique authority with respect to regulatory authority and liability relief with respect to the acquisition, disposition, development, and or redevelopment of those kinds of property. Brownfield, I believe, is the term that's used most commonly. With respect to eminent domain, redevelopment agencies do have that authority under law. Your eminent domain policy authorized the use of eminent domain to take properties on which any person resided. And there were a substantial number of low or moderate income people who resided in the project area. You would have to create, as a part of your redevelopment plan adoption process, what's called a project area committee. That is a committee that's put in place by vote of property owners and residents, business people of the project area as proposed. And if the project area committee at the end of the process recommended against approving the proposed redevelopment plan, the only way the city council could adopt that redevelopment plan is with a supermajority 4/5 vote of the city council. So the project area committee has some tooth. They would not just be a body just to make recommendations that may not be considered by the legislative body, but the redevelopment law has given that body, if one is put in place, some tooth with respect to what is actually done with respect to adoption of the redevelopment plan. I'm going to pass this on to Doug now.
We want to spend a minute and talk about the financing mechanism for redevelopment. Tax increment financing was originally authorized back in 1952, and it's the mechanism by which redevelopment agencies fund projects. When the project area is formed, a base year valuation is established. That's the current value of all the property in the proposed project area. Everything that occurs after that point, any type of growth, even the 2% increases that are allowed under Prop 13, will increase the value of the project area such that the additional taxes over and above the base year accrue to the redevelopment agency. In this example we've got here, the base year is the horizontal line across the middle. $50,000 of property taxes would apply to a property that's worth $5 million using the 1% basic tax rate. So let's say you've got a parcel that has an older commercial property. It's worth $5 million when we form the project area. And then after the project area is formed, activities occur on that site, something new is built, and now it's worth $10 million. So now it's generating $100,000 of property taxes. The additional $50,000 on top of the base $50,000 then would accrue to the project and to the redevelopment agency. Excuse me. So again, very important. Redevelopment does not directly cause an increase in property taxes, affect property tax rates, or decrease property values in and of itself. Again, it's a redistribution of additional taxes over and above the base year. And that's really how the legislature intended it. It's not to increase taxes. It's to redistribute things after the project is formed. One of the things that property tax increment is used for and must be used for, according to the law, is for affordable housing. The basic requirement is that for every dollar that comes in to the redevelopment agency, 20% of that must be set aside for projects that benefit low and moderate income housing. So a special fund will actually be set up. A low-moderate income housing fund will accrue your 20% of tax increment. There's some other requirements that apply to housing. The inclusionary requirements state that if any new homes are built in the project area, let's say a new tract was built, the agency is actually obligated to provide low-mod units approximately 15% or can be 30% depending on who's developing the project. But it's a requirement that the agency come up with low-mod units when new units are being built in town, no matter who the developer is. Even if it's the agency, it's one set of numbers. If it's the developer, that also applies and creates an obligation for the redevelopment agency. Replacement housing units are displaced or destroyed, the agency would have an obligation to replace those with equivalent low-mod units as well. Something new that came about in 2001, the legislature noticed that a lot of redevelopment agencies were accruing their 20% dollars but weren't actually spending them. So there's some excess surplus requirements now that require you basically to start spending the money. You can't just set aside the 20% and camp on it. You have to actually use it for projects. I'm going to give this back to John to talk about the general plan aspects.
Before I get to general plan, I'd like to just add one other note here to the whole concept of decrease in property values if our property is put into a redevelopment project area. The whole concept of tax increment financing, and for tax increment financing to work, property values have to go up. If property values decline, tax increment financing doesn't work. So since 1952, there's been over 750 redevelopment project areas created, and if tax increment financing was not working, if things were going in reverse, the whole concept of tax increment financing would not work. So I think plan has to be consistent with your city general plan. And in every situation where I have worked with a redevelopment agency, and I've been doing this for 24 years, every redevelopment plan has followed the city's general plan land use map with respect to land use authority and policy. Really, modern redevelopment practice does not establish a separate land use authority in the redevelopment plan. So it would be our recommendation in Morro Bay, if you moved forward, that your general plan would provide the land use policy, and of course your zoning code would be your zoning. So as people who went to develop vacant properties in a project area or who went to make improvements to their property, they would have to follow your general plan and the subordinate zoning ordinance with respect to those kinds of activities. The fact that it's in a redevelopment project area doesn't change that. Okay. We're still in the primer. Project area delineation requirements. These are basic because there's so much detail in the code, but we wanted to cover the basic concepts with respect to project area delineation and how the law says that you are supposed to create a project area. With respect to contiguity, shape, size, and land uses, the law doesn't care. A project area does not have to be contiguous. That is, you can have subcomponent parts to your redevelopment project area. It can be any shape. It can be any size. The largest redevelopment project area I have worked on was a military reuse project in San Bernardino County. It's 54,000 acres, and it was a multi-jurisdictional project. I don't know the smallest project area I've worked in. Usually the projects are, I don't think I've worked in something smaller than 200 acres, Doug, do you? So the point being that you can have any size project area. It has to make fiscal sense. I guess that's probably the biggest point that has to be observed in that regard. With respect to land uses, redevelopment project areas have included multitude of land uses. There is no restriction in that way. With respect to urbanization, since 1984, there has been a requirement that not less than 80% of your redevelopment project area be urbanized. There are several subsets to that, but I don't want to get into that level of detail. Just know that not less than 20% of your project area has to be urban area. With respect to blight, there has to be both physical and economic components of blight found within your redevelopment project area. That's why Alonzo and AGA are a part of this team. The primary blight characteristics are defined in section 33030 and 33031 and other sections of the redevelopment law. With respect to physical conditions, there are four primary indicators. With respect to economic conditions, there are six primary indicators. Our methodology looks at cumulative aspects of those primary indicators because in many cases you cannot find simply by review of a property. One of the four principal characteristics of blight as defined in the code, what you have to do is look at the smaller component parts of a property, and then you look at a cumulative basis the aspects of a property that may or may not add up to one of those primary characteristics of blight as identified in the code. And we'll go over that a little bit more when we talk about the specifics of the Morro Bay feasibility study. It's interesting to note that since 1994, when there was a very substantial change in redevelopment law, that inadequate public improvements, with the exception of sewer and water, are not primary characteristics of blight. In other words, you cannot base a redevelopment project area around deficient roadways, the fact that you have no curbs, no gutters, no sidewalks, poor drainage facilities, you have floods. The state legislature doesn't care about that anymore. However, you can use those conditions to support your blight findings with respect to economic and physical conditions that are defined in the code. So we use those as an overlay. They are not parcel specific. Now, the conditions can combine with respect to physical and economic blight, as defined in the code, must be prevalent and substantial, and it must be a burden on the community. And there has to be a need for redevelopment such that improvements can't be made without redevelopment being an active part of improvements to that project area. Interesting thing is that prevalent and substantial burden on the community is not defined in the redevelopment law. The City Council, acting as the decision-making body in this process, would make findings. Those findings would be included in the ordinance adopting and approving. The last component we want to talk about as a basic tenet of creating a project area is the rule of necessity, which provides that non-blighted parcels are permitted within a redevelopment project area. In fact, I can't identify a redevelopment project area that doesn't contain non-blighted parcels. In fact, you'll find, for the most part, most redevelopment project areas created have an abundance of non-blighted parcels. But what has to occur is that the conditions of blight within a project area have to be pervasive. Courts have found that blight is an area-wide concept. So what has to be found is that the inclusion of non-blighted parcels are necessary for effective redevelopment of the larger area. And effective for redevelopment can mean needed for affordable housing construction. For relocation purposes, as you conduct redevelopment in the project area, it may be necessary to relocate businesses to new areas and vice versa. Or for other substantial justification, Our methodology assumes good planning. The redevelopment project area is a substantial justification, as well as the impacts of external obsolescence. External obsolescence provides that there is a negative impact on the value of properties within a relationship of a blighted parcel. We use the 300-foot rule. Pardon? Oh, go ahead. Sure.
Yeah. I always keep having this issue of external obsolescence because we, quote unquote, do the economic analysis component of this. And external obsolescence goes to the issue of if I am not a blighted property, how am I affected by that blighted property? When I try to explain to people the use of the 300-foot rule, what people can commonly get their head around this concept of external obsolescence. It's the same way in which you would be notified, either through your city council planning commission hearings, where people around a property seeking some sort of approval through the city, you notify those folks that a hearing is in place. For a variance, you notify generally within 300-foot rule because a change and alteration to the property may affect the surrounding properties. Conditional use permit, you do the same thing. The 300-foot is a standard notification rule used. But there's also notifications for other types of facilities and communities, and also the placement of facilities. It's recognition that certain over in the surrounding area, and that's kind of the external obsolescence precedent that's used by the process evaluation that's going to be presented today, in that there's a strong precedent sent through the notification that people who have to be affected by a certain activity or improvement are notified, and that's where the 300-foot rule, and you'll find that right now it's presented tonight is an even a conservative interpretation of that to bring forth a recommended project area around it. So.
Thanks, Alonzo. And we'll get into more of that as we talk about the specifics of Morro Bay's feasibility study. Final point we want to make in the primer is that there are consultations required. Consultations with affected taxing entities. Those would be the county government, affected schools, mosquito abatement district, flood control district, whoever is receiving, whatever entity is receiving a share of the ad valorem property tax dollars and may be a contributor to your redevelopment program would have to be consulted and advised of the program. You also have to consult with your community, and you guys are off to a great start. It's your second workshop, and we're still at home base. So, and I noticed there are members in the community, and we are on television. So you're off to a great start in that regard. Okay, now we're going to start talking about the actual feasibility study itself and the objectives of that study. First one was that...
Can I interrupt you just one second?
Yes, ma'am.
I just want to ask the council, do you have any questions on the primer, on the basics? Because that I want to make sure everybody's clear on where we are now.
Just a quick follow-up along the lines of consultations. As it's currently proposed, we're talking about extending this decision to July 13th. What sort of outreach would there be with some of the entities that are referred to in here along those lines, so we had a bit of an idea about where they might be going or some of their perspective when we make that decision on the 13th? Is there a possibility we could have some feedback from them to help us in our decision on the 13th or a possible decision there?
Is there a legal obligation?
No. Actually, personally, I have a preference that we would have some ability to give them an opportunity for feedback and an awareness, I guess, generally of the direction they may see.
You worked with the Planning Commission and the Redevelopment Agency Board, and you've created a preliminary project area boundary. You've drawn up the legal description. At that point in time, you would send a copy of the legal description, the proposed project area boundary map, and a statement of commencement of redevelopment planning activities. You would send that out to each of the affected taxing entities. We would identify who those are based on records from the State Board of Equalization tax rate area maps. So every one of the affected taxing entities would be notified, and from that point in time, which would probably be once you initiated the process and you got to that point, probably be 9 more months of processing this particular plan adoption process. You would have ample time to meet with them as really as much as you want. Whether or not you do it prior to that is a political decision.
I guess personally, I just want to avoid us getting further down the road and discovering that there are significant challenges from this conversation and this interaction, and that we do what we can to address it as early as possible so we have the ability to weigh that in our decision as we move forward.
If I might add, based on our previous experience here in San Luis Obispo County, both in Arroyo Grande and Rover Beach, the county scrutinized carefully what was going on with respect to the creation of those project areas, and it was negotiated that some areas proposed for inclusion were taken out. So I doubt that the administration at county government has changed drastically in that regard, and given the state of the economy, I would expect all the taxing entities to scrutinize the creation of a project area in the county. And so I would say it wouldn't necessarily be a bad idea to approach them prior to commencing, but again, that's your decision.
I've got a related question to that. You referred to two other cities. What about Pismo Beach and the situation they had with their school district? How did that happen, and how would we avoid that?
I'm not averse on the particular situation with the school district. I am aware of a situation. The Pismo Beach redevelopment project area, as originally composed, I know included a lot of non-taxable properties. So they were not generating a lot of tax increment. And I don't know the agreement between the school district and the agency. I'm not sure when the project area was actually adopted personally. So I don't know if it was before 1994 when the rules were different.
To be a continued threat, or did the court decision on that remove it?
Yeah, I don't know. We do know that the courts overruled the state in their attempt to take agency monies. That has happened in the past through education revenue augmentation funding, and schools have been backfilled by redevelopment agency monies. I don't think, Doug, can we?
No crystal ball. I understand that. But does it look like we should get into this now, or is this still dicey?
Yeah, I think we see a new proposal every other day from Sacramento. The original threat, which was to take surplus monies from RDAs, was challenged and successfully. And the state, I think, is working on a new way to try to come at the cities to try to get some of that redevelopment money. And there was actually something sent out, I think, yesterday from the California Redevelopment Association with the latest proposal from Sacramento. So who knows where that's going to go? I mean, it's.
And when they say take the redevelopment money, are they trying to take a portion of the tax increment that the cities are getting? Is that what they're doing?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. In the past.
It's not the whole amount. They're just trying to get into that.
Sure. And this has occurred actually in the past. And the mechanism that they use to borrow, actually take money from RDAs, is through the ERAF, which is the Educational Revenue Augmentation Fund. So under the guise of giving the money to schools, which then helps the state because they don't have to backfill the schools, they draw. And in the past, it's been anywhere from 1% to 3% of certain RDA's tax increment money. So it's not a huge amount on any individual RDA, but when you aggregate over 400 RDAs throughout the state, it's hundreds of millions of dollars that they've taken in the past, and they're trying to do it again. So we don't know where that's going to go right now.
Okay, Rick?
Thank you. If you could just clear something up for me. So the property values after redevelopment would go up. So why wouldn't the property taxes would correspondingly go up?
Yes.
Okay. That's
right.
And so you started off with AG in 1997. Where are they at in the process, and how did their scope of work compare to our proposed scope of work?
Are you familiar with where they are right now?
No, we're not working with Arroyo Grande at this point in time. It would be possible. The state assembles a report which compiles data. Some of the data that's concluded is the amount of tax increment on an annual basis that's generated by redevelopment agencies. We don't have that with us. We do know that they have been working to each of the increment that has to be spent for those income categories. I don't know the exact percentage. We could provide that for you via email if you'd like at a later date.
Okay, and you touched very briefly on contaminated properties, and I'm wondering, are you talking about ground contamination? What do you mean about
that? I believe the code provides for contamination in, on, or under. So it would involve all kinds of contamination. Okay. And the provisions in the CCRL also define petroleum-based contaminants as something that the agency could be involved in remediating, whereas I know federal standards don't do that.
And let's just simplify it. Say you have a block that's up for redevelopment, and somebody in that block doesn't want to participate. Is eminent domain the only option that you have in a case like that?
Well, it would be an option. I think the first thing you'd want to do, even if you had eminent domain authority, would be to do everything you could to negotiate the purchase. If you couldn't do that, and you had to have that particular piece of property to execute a larger redevelopment project that would be of significant benefit to the community. If you didn't have eminent domain to take the property, you wouldn't be able to execute that project. I mean, we've actually had communities that didn't have a grocery store. So if in that particular community, if you had a grocery store operator who said, look, this is the area we need to locate, the agency was able to accumulate the properties to make that happen, with the exception of one property. The agency has to make the decision, is the grocery store the greater good for the community, or is this individual maintaining their ownership of that property, which is the greatest benefit to the community? You would have to make that political decision. If you had the authority to take property through the redevelopment plan using eminent domain, and it allowed for whatever land use type that was involved here, you could use eminent domain to take that property. You could move forward with your grocery store. So it is a tool. It is a tool that almost every redevelopment agency that we work with to create a project area employs. It usually is structured these days, modern post-Kelo in particular, to exclude the taking of residential properties. I don't know if that's the policy that you would want to assume. That's something you'll have to work on determining, and you'll have several months to do that. But it is something you would want to consider.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Any other questions?
Yeah, just if necessary. But they work together. They work in parallel. They're not at all in conflict. As a matter of fact, it probably makes it more achievable to satisfy those requirements when we have the resources of the Low to Moderate Income Housing Fund.
So just to confirm it, we seem to be out of balance with our very low and low income projects. So this potentially could help us address those and catch up then.
Okay. And the interesting thing is, too, that if the agency makes findings, it can use its LMI monies outside a project area. So if you wanted to spend those monies outside the project area for special housing needs, you could do that.
Madam Mayor, he means outside the project area, but within our community. So maybe not necessarily, but somewhere else in Morro Bay.
Okay, thank you for letting us get those questions out. And I would also advise the audience, if you have questions, write them down. When we have our second public comment, we'll get to those and certainly get them answered.
Okay. Okay, feasibility study objectives. The first objective was to delineate a potential project area based upon strict compliance with the CCRL. We want to emphasize strict. Given our experience here in this county and given our experience in other counties, and again, I want to emphasize we're all aware of the economic situation we're in today. We would anticipate that all affected tax entities would look at any proposal and make sure that you're doing everything you can to meet the intent of complying with all the requirements of the redevelopment law as it is today. Staff provided a designated area of interest, which we've referred to in the study and will refer to further on here as the AOI. That included 1,711 parcels covering 618 total acres. And it did include the Dynegy power plant. And if this works, we have an exhibit here that shows that the area of interest. So this is the area of interest as provided to Urban Futures by staff. And I can blow that up if you'd like and move through that. Bruce, I don't know, maybe you would, if there are some key landmarks or whatnot you'd like to identify as I scroll down.
Well, he's moving from north to down, but it generally follows the alignment of Main Street, inclusive in terms, we've included roughly, I would easily say 70% of the entire community is a study area, and we figured we'll let them look at the whole thing and then see what they can work out of that, what meets the test for blight, economic and physical.
And I think for study purposes, the area that we were given made a lot of sense. And I think most communities would want to start with, well, let's look at our downtown. It's older, and some of us might think it looks tired. And so we should definitely look at that, and we definitely did. So, and I think the report described our findings.
For the sake of the public, as you get to that point in your presentation, will you talk a little more about why that wasn't included? Mm-hmm.
The next objective of the feasibility program was to identify the tax increment benefits that would accrue to the redevelopment agency based on a potential redevelopment project area. Then to identify potential community concerns. And I think in this regard, based on our collective experience, it's probably easy to say that the real concern most people in the community have is eminent domain. So I think we want to put that on the table and have the council be very aware of that and know that your deliberations regarding that issue, realizing the importance in all aspects, that you have time to deliberate on that. And outline the next planning steps and time frame involved in creating a project area. Okay, the first thing that we did with respect to looking at a potential redevelopment project area here in Morro Bay was to look at physical conditions. We analyzed the physical conditions. What we did was we conducted a parcel-specific analysis, and we reviewed conditions on the ground for blight indicators and land use assessment. And what the first thing we did when we got back to the office and we loaded everything into the computer, we started to run analyses. With respect to urbanization, you recall that not less than 80% of the project area has to be urbanized. So we found that the entire area of interest was adequately urbanized. And we believe we probably could have, from that perspective, included the entire potential the area of interest in a redevelopment project area, assuming there were no other test of law. So the area, again, here's the area of interest. These are land uses that are in that area of interest. So with respect to urbanization is not an issue. I think anywhere within the area of interest, that is not something to be concerned with. The next issue that we looked at was the issue regarding blight, physical blight. Alonzo's going to talk about economic blight here in a minute. He's a very, very patient guy. We look at our methodology employs an analysis that considers 40 physical blight indicators. Some of these are identified here. They include functional obsolescence, incompatible land uses, unreinforced masonry, unpermitted or faulty construction, private infrastructure issues, paint, garage conversions, abandoned and inoperable vehicles, overgrown vegetation, poor site layout condition, fire hazards, hazardous walkways and stairways, and a whole host of others. I just wanted to highlight some of these here. You see that some of these are identified in the text, and they are bolded. Those are direct connections to the CCRL four primary blight characteristics. If we find those conditions in the field, those parcels are automatically identified as blighted because, in the perspective of the redevelopment law, all we have to have is one of those conditions, and a parcel will be blighted. So with respect to functional obsolescence or incompatible land uses, unreinforced masonry, which is a big issue in some downtown, older downtown areas, and in this particular community, in working with staff to go over the findings, because it's appropriate, we would transfer to staff our findings and have them verify those. So in several cases, we were able to do that, look at their greater expertise with respect to functional obsolescence, unreinforced masonry, construction issues, fire hazards, garage conversions, and those kinds of things. But with respect to unreinforced masonry, you would look at the downtown buildings, and you see any number of them are constructed with masonry. We suspected that maybe some of those, if not all of those, may have had unreinforced masonry seismic issues. We were quite surprised that very, very few actually did. So our blight findings had to be reduced based on the findings that was as verified by city staff. In those cases where we do not have the direct, that's really a wonderful piece of art, but as a novice, you don't know why that piece of art is what it is. As someone who's not been involved in this profession as long as I have, you could look at a piece of property and you could say, there's something wrong with that property. It looks blighted. And in fact, there was a very big article about one of our legislators in the Los Angeles Times the other day about one of the legislators who was not maintaining her properties and is creating a blight in the neighborhood. And there's quite an uproar about that particular property. Well, it's interesting because some of the issues that are being described by people in the community are in many ways some of the same kinds of things that we look for, and that we add those up on a cumulative basis, and we assign a weighting system of points. So those points or those categories of blight indicator that we find in the field, if they are heavily weighted towards health and safety issues, such as a garage conversion, for instance, we assign that a much higher weighting than we would, say, inoperable vehicles. So those indicators that are health and safety issues are highly weighted. Those that are more of an aesthetic issue are lowly weighted. We look at a parcel that has 20 or more cumulative blight points as being a blighted parcel. We identify that on our exhibits as a red parcel. That is a blighted parcel. In our opinion, the City Council could identify and find in their findings that those parcels are in and of themselves blighted. We found 132 parcels, or 28.2%, of parcels accumulating a 20-plus weighted blight point situation in the area that we're going to identify as a potential project area. So in addition to the parcel-specific analysis that we conduct, we also look at additional layers of data. We have additional discussions with public officials, and we review and analyze the existing database. With respect to public utilities and infrastructure, we look at sewer, water, flood control, conditions of roads, public safety. We discuss housing issues, code enforcement issues. With respect to planning, we look at land use and environmental issues. Then we have a picture with what has been successful in other communities, and it helps us then to redefine the potential project area boundaries. And that's the methodology that we've used here. The four projects that we have used as comparable projects in this case are the cities of Galt, McFarland, Redlands, and Wasco. And we've used those for these reasons. They employed the same UFI and AGA methodologies. They were adopted in the post-SB 1206 era, which is January 1, 2007, when I said that the blight requirements have changed in the CCRL. Each of these projects received extensive scrutiny. For instance, McFarland and Wasco, we conducted field reviews with county staff as a part of the process. In the city of Redlands, there were 11 community organizations that were involved from the grassroots efforts to create that redevelopment project area. In fact, that project area was created from the community's efforts. It was not a political decision. It was the community decision to have that built. So there was a very, very high scrutiny with respect to each of these projects. So we wanted to bring the benefit of those past projects here to the city of Morro Bay and use these as comparable projects so that you would have an idea as to what we believed would be substantial and prevalent in this condition. So the comparable projects that we used averaged 29.5% parcels with 20 or plus weighted blight points. And this is kind of how that breaks down. You can see the blue and the green. The blue columns show the number of parcels and blight, the number of parcels by percentage that we found to be blighted. You can see Galt to the far left. You can see McFarland. Again, the blue are the number of blighted parcels. You can see North Redlands. And you can see Wasco. And then you can see the average of all of those projects together. And then you can see Morro Bay. So the area, the proposed project area boundaries that we have proposed are right about at the average of those four project areas. We believe that that's an acceptable benchmark with respect to the criterion of blight in establishing a redevelopment project area. It's also, if you can enlarge a redevelopment project area simply because we provide these findings, no, we can't do that. If the political decision is to create a larger project area, you could say that's what you want to do. If you wanted to create a smaller project area, you could say that's what you want to do. But for us to come before you and give our recommendations using our methodology, we have to be able to give a recommendation to you based on our methodology and what we believe and what we have found given our experience in the past. And we believe that the approach and methodology and the recommendations we have provided to you do just that. Necessity. Necessity, then, as we talked earlier, you can include redevelopment projects, in redevelopment projects, parcels that are not blighted. And that does reflect a balance between blight and substantial justification. Again, vacant land for purposes of relocation and affordable housing, the impacts of external obsolescence. And then we believe that the project area as proposed provides a very, very effective balance in that regard. With respect to necessity, we have 337 parcels in a project area. So what that says is that every parcel that would not be included or that is not red and that would be included in the potential project area would be a color other than red. I'm not showing you the boundary of the potential project area because I don't want to get ahead of myself, but just know that every property that is not shown on this map as blighted, if this was the potential project area, every parcel that was not red would be included because it was necessary for effective redevelopment in one of those fashions that I described earlier. Economic conditions, Alonzo.
Let me begin by distinguishing a little bit about the economic condition analysis as opposed to the physical. John has explained factors or criteria very much affixed to the ground, very much affixed to these parcels, and therefore that allows them to do a parcel-specific analysis, and you just saw the mapping of the land uses and the urbanization and conditions. The economic analysis deals with things that are not necessarily always specific to a given parcel, although a given parcel may be affected by those type of conditions in forms of confidential information, as perhaps it relates to business operator performance of an individual business storefront owner or something. So for that reason, the analysis has to go to an area-specific level of analysis, and the fact that the data, mining the data down to an individual level is very difficult and problematic. And so just a caveat as to the way our analysis. However, like the physical blight analysis, we do undertake a very detailed field audit of conditions. In this area, we surveyed over 700,000 square feet of building space, measured it and classified it by type of activity. And we use a lot of that in-field data as it relates to some of the factors to be evaluated. Also, what we do in terms of our analytical approach, we use what I call comparative analysis. How do conditions within an area compare with either the broader community the county which it is a part, or other benchmark measures representing either a normative or an expected level of activity. And so we did look in certain instances at the area of interest and also the potential project area versus the city, the county, and some other benchmarks that are in the report. They have to do with median levels of sales performance or storefront mix, storefront incidence of storefronts per capita, things of that nature. There's one tension that always goes between our two firms is I'm always crying to these guys, how come the area doesn't look, you know, it's always so extended out, can't you include more? Because from an economic standpoint, it's easier to evaluate a nice, you know, consolidated mass as opposed to an extended area. But I'm always reminded the law identifies a two-sided coin here. It requires both physical and economic. And without the physical, it doesn't matter how much economic. If we don't have the corresponding physical conditions in the area, then the area cannot be affected, deemed affected by blight. So it's a two-sided coin. So therefore, because their process is involved the way it is, they'll take the lead and oftentimes define the broad trajectory boundaries based on the need for urbanization and external obsolescence and things of that factor. We will then evaluate that area or iterations of that area to find out whether or not economic blight factors are evident. A lot of the factors we evaluate are not readily seen from the road. It just they weren't redirecting the money to the paint on the side of the building. So it's very difficult to drive by and say, oh, that thing looks bad or that thing looks good. And if you read the paper, there's a lot of evidence of in these posh projects where the tenants are having difficulty. It's very difficult to see what's going on behind the front entry of the door from just a street curb. So we have to look at things that are not evident by simply driving by. And we look at six factors in the characteristics. We call the primary characteristics. And whereas Urban Futures has these 40 indicators, we do also have sub-indicators. We primarily roll them up into these broad primary indicators. And the first one has to do with the property value, whether it be stagnant or depreciated within the area we're evaluating. In stagnant depreciated, it means is if it's unduly low in respect to other properties of similar size, it's somewhat of an appraisal exercise, if you will, where appraisal will evaluate one piece of property and why is that property down? Well, we don't do on a site-specific appraisal level, but if the ambient value of homes or ambient value of property when a certain area seems to be lower compared to comparable size, the surrounding area or what I call competitive market area properties, there's a number of factors contributing to that. Okay, and the law doesn't talk about why, it just wants you to determine whether or not it exists. And the other thing has to do with the stagnant. The inability, typically what happens is as areas compete, there's a tendency towards the normative when markets become an equilibrium. If an area is constantly pushed down in terms of its values, its inability to respond to market behavior, it's basically a depression. It remains stagnant relative to the properties in which it competes. So if it continues to lag, that's an indicator of stagnation in the property value, or if it absolutely is flat. Property values do go up and down, as we've learned within the last 18 months, if you didn't already know. And so we look at that relative, so we try and do a historical time frame. So if we were simply to compare values today as they were a year and a half ago, oh, the thing is plummeting. Well, it's not only dropping in Morro Bay, it's dropping all over. So we have to broaden our analysis to compare how our values change in other locations. And we primarily checked, I think it was six coastal communities on San Luis Obispo County. And we compared the value trends within those over the last 3 years with Morro Bay. The second factor has to do with hazardous materials, a hazardous substance, and how it might affect property value. That's the second factor. It's very problematic in terms of cost of doing those when somebody goes to remediate their properties. But consider the question that has to be asked, how are the property values being affected by the potential presence or recognized presence of hazardous materials on the site? And that's what we try and evaluate when we look at that issue. The other factor, the third factor, is the overcrowding. And it's in a perfect world, no, there would be no overcrowding. But that's not a reality. an equal reality, at least in this country, is that all units would not be overcrowded either. What we look at in terms of this comparative analysis, what is the incidence of overcrowding within our area relative to the surrounding community of which it's a part or the surrounding county in which housing exists? And for example, if somebody's looking for a home, they'll look in Pismo Beach, or they'll look in San Luis Obispo, or they'll look here, and they'll look up around. They'll look around trying to figure out what fits their ability to afford. And so people will go to where they can afford the housing or where they can find suitable housing or housing at least works for them. So we look at the county in which the project area exists. The other factor related to that is a lot of studies with regards to the incidence of poverty and strong evidence of a high incidence of overcrowding with households at two times the poverty level. So we also, as an attendant, we look at the incidence of poverty within the project area. The other factor law has to look at is the vacancies and lease rates. And that has more to do with the commercial properties within the area. The vacancy abnormally high relative to what you should expect. High incidence of vacancy, or normally high incidence of vacancy, and it's difficult for people to use this storefront. Either it points to the back alley, it doesn't point to the street, there's no parking, you know, you have to risk life or limb to get into the store, pull your car into the storefront, and once you're there, you know, you're going to get hit trying to pull out of it. You know, these types of factors affect whether or not that's a desirable location. And usually a high rate of vacancy indicates that it's a problematic space. It could be that there's thread wiring in the ceiling and nobody wants to have inventory laid out with a high risk, you know, fire risk building. There's any number of factors that could relate to that. Attended to that is the fact that oftentimes to induce somebody to occupy, you have to beat down the lease rates. So it's a great deal, but it may cost you just to ready the space for whatever either retail or industrial use, whatever function is going to take place within the building. The fifth factor we're looking at is this adequacy of commercial facilities. And that more relates to the ability of the commercial resources within the area to serve the community need. In Morro Bay was a little challenging in that there's such a high incidence of visitor population. And so if you look at the aggregate numbers, they're not doing so bad. But you also have to consider to what share of the business activities, general merchandise, dining, and fueling needs, a whole variety. It's typically your nine major categories that State Board of Equalization reports. And so we evaluated it against that. The last factor has to do with the threat of crime and public safety risk. And we, prior to doing these blight studies, we've been doing fiscal impact studies for communities throughout the state, and you have 150 of these things. And what we've done is we, for purpose of estimating the cost of police services for a variety of types of land use, we've worked with a lot of police officials in developing ways to identify how the varying cost of service to different type of land use and what you'd expect that cost to be based on varying levels of cost. And then we've also, for purposes of this study, compared what the actual level of service activity to the, in an area is compared to what should be expected. And we basically use that to assess the risk, the threat of crime and public safety risk. If an area is demanding a disproportionate amount of policing activity, basically what it's doing, it's responding to a perceived risk of a crime threat, either by a trained patrolled officer or a concerned business owner or individual who's prompted to call out of concern, perceived threat, officer who's responding for purpose of intervention or sequestering perceived threat. And so it's an indicator that this area is commanding a lot more activity than should be typical of a community. And we look at the density, the population density, community, the overall population of the community to figure out what kind of level. And then we compare that. And that's how we assess whether or not the area in question is generating a disproportionate or high level of policing activity, and that has to do with more or less also creating an economic burden on the community, because as you well know, policing costs is a significant part of the general fund operating budget, and it's just costly. It's a necessary cost, and so when you overburden it, you basically burdens the ability to redirect resources to other needs in the community. Secondly, also it creates, depending on the severity of that, it creates a public safety risk in other parts of the community because so many policing resources are focused in this one problem area that, you know, the other taxpayers aren't benefiting from that level of protection. So those are six things that we look at. The extent that the air is affected by these, we get back to the issue of substantial and prevalent, and we look at the incidents. And well, the reality is a crime, quote-unquote, report a crime is not a happen, except the effect of that crime. Or if you pull into an area that's been blasted by graffiti and it's like, gee, I won't even come here. I'll go to the shop down the road where I don't feel impacted by these. These are some of these things that create a prevalence and a substantial effect. And that's how we use policing to monitor some of that in terms of the crime activity. And then the economic burden, which I touched on earlier. Finally, these are factors we evaluate, and at a degree, the economic dislocation might be found. And basically, according to these relevant CCR requirements. And since 2007, I jokingly say what the changes in 2007 has created what I call a steeplechase. There's hurdles of analysis that have to be cleared. And there's a whole host of other things we used to evaluate that genuinely could fall in the category as blight. But they've been removed. So, you know, I can't. It's one of those, you know, I jokingly say it's like the person on the stand said, yes, I killed him, and, you know, and they turned to the jury and said, disavow that statement. You know, it's like, okay, you know, we have to ignore certain things that we know, in my analysis, evaluating market analysis for development, that effectively would not be, could not be overcome by the local government, by private investment, if not for the sake of some external third funding source, which we call redevelopment. But as 2007, a number of those factors have simply been jettisoned from the law, and we can't look at those. So we're left with these six tenants, recognized blight, and that's what we work with.
Still here.
Oh, okay. So now we get to this potential project area boundary, which was looking at all the criteria to a level of significance that becomes in the area itself becomes substantial and prevalent. And as you can see, with regards to the previous slide, the potential project area with the power plant now has 331 acres, whereas the area of interest, which was the map shown earlier, had 618 acres. The potential project area now encompasses 469 parcels, where the area of interest for the area we began to focus had over 1,700 parcels. Yet the area still remains substantially vacant. Only 8% are substantially urbanized, only 8% of the total area being vacant at this time. And so if you look at this chart, you'll see that the, if you can focus in on that, you see some of the detail. The brown colored, and we can't put that area in, or at least his recommendation is that we don't include that, or at least the potential project area, according to the criteria, doesn't include that portion of Morro Bay Boulevard. Because you may have my side of the coin, but you need John's side of the coin. In terms of you may have the economic, but you need the physical as well under the law. So both sides of the coin. That's part of the reason why the boundary looks like it does. Mm-hmm. It's a dual test. If we could only take one or the other, yeah, we could put a lot more. So, but that's kind of where we're at with the potential project area boundary.
Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to interrupt now because it was a question from the audience, too, and I think it's one all of us share. We can't understand why Main Street, Morro Bay Boulevard area would not be included. Mm-hmm. There's empty storefronts, there's empty lots. And why is that not qualifying?
Well, it's an issue of the physical conditions under the criteria, the indicators, the 40 indicators. They do not stack up to that blight level for physical blight. And because of the fact that the law has removed some of the other criteria, such as the lack of infrastructure as a primary driver, was it what we're living in is an increasingly, it's like they're pulling the fences in tighter and tighter under the California Community Redevelopment Law. So the problem is, well, I jokingly say, well, the problem is you apply logic and reason to the issue. You know, it's like, you know, you approach this rationally, you know, and so we're dealing with Yes, but it has to also be recognized under the community redevelopment law.
Let me add. I think you know, Lonzo. I think he addressed the issue of vacant storefronts, inadequate lease rates, those kinds of economic issues, and we addressed the conditions of physical blight. I mentioned the 40 indicators. We looked at every parcel in the area of interest. And we looked for those various indicators. And again, it's like looking at the picture on the wall. You might drive by a parcel and you look at it one way and you say, oh, well, gee, that should be included in a redevelopment project area because for whatever reason. But we conduct our analysis and we look through those 40 points that we're looking for every parcel. And we tabulate those. When we get back to the office, we're completely objective. And the computer comes up with the data analysis. You folks have been here for many years. I'm sure there are many people in the community who were born here. It's a great place to be born, a great place to live. But as an outsider, someone who's coming in and looking extremely objectively and looking for these issues and comporting to the California Community Redevelopment Law, who has experience in the county of San Luis Obispo, exterior counties, we want to bring that to you to keep you out of trouble. We didn't find the conditions in your downtown to be substantial and prevalent with respect to the conditions of blight, the blight requirement. And Alonzo's firm found the same situation with regard to economic blight indicators. While the town may have certain aspects of being tired, tired does not make blight. While it may have a number of buildings that are old, old does not make blight. In fact, old can make charm and character. So we have to differentiate ourselves. We have to be objective observers, and the analysis is what it is.
Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt again. If the rest of the council has questions too, but
sure.
I'm thinking more of the empty lots. There's a bunch of empty lots in our downtown. That doesn't constitute blight for a redevelopment agency?
Well, no, you can put empty lots in a project area, but and we make every effort to include a vacant parcel in a downtown or in a redevelopment project area. We have included a number of those in the proposed project area. Are there vacant lots that we didn't include? Yes. You can't simply just take a vacant lot and put it into your project area and another vacant lot and put it into your project area. It just wouldn't make good planning sense. It would be extremely difficult to implement that kind of a strategy. And if we look at, you know, the other aspects of blight and urbanization, necessity, again, we arrived at the boundary that we arrived at looking at all those various tests. Now, you as the city council, could you say, gee, we appreciate what you've done, but we'd like to include our downtown. We believe it should be in. I can't say you shouldn't do that, but beware that if you do that, the challenge of risk is going to be greater. And if you want to assume that risk, there's nothing that we could say that you shouldn't do that.
Graphically, it was shown there with that chart that showed the blue and the green little look like that. But they also had widespread community support and the political support. So the only consultation, as you march south of there, you also need to be looking around to garner support for that direction. Is one thing. But there's, you know, you may, if there was no political will, we could be at 75%, and it still wouldn't happen. It comes down to this largely political problem.
If I might add, Mr. Councilman, while we're on this issue, I just pulled up the map, and what this map shows is an inventory of the conditions that we found in the entire area of interest. But being we're talking about the downtown area, we can focus on the downtown area. And again, I said those parcels that are red, or in several instances, the parcels are quite large and they're ringed in red. Those are parcels we believe that contain 20 or more blighting indicators, and that are also with respect to economic blight are supported, and that the City Council could find as being blighted in and of themselves. I don't believe you see a lot of those in the downtown area. Now, the other gradients of color represent those kinds of things, the indicators that we did find and that we weighted and that were added up. You can see the tan is showing those parcels where we found 1 or 9 points of blight based on the indicators. The pink is a score of 10 to 19 score of blight indicators, and the red, of course, is 20 or more. Yeah, it is in the study.
Figure 7.
So if we take the red parcels and then we apply the methodology applies the principle of externalities and external obsolescence, we start with a 300 foot boundary. In this case, the comparable projects, we would not have met the 30%, approximately 30% blight standard that we were looking to meet. We dropped it to 200 feet, the external obsolescence impact boundary, and we did not meet the about 30% threshold that we were looking to meet. We drop it to 100, and we meet that, because what we see happening is that that 100-foot boundary starts to mesh, and we see pods of areas that are affected by conditions of blight, blighted parcels, those parcels that are red. Then we draw a boundary around that, and entities, including the city of Morro Bay, the county of San Luis Obispo, the schools, and other affected taxing entities. So they're all contributing dollars to your redevelopment effort, and the redevelopment law says you as a city are entitled to create a redevelopment project area after you establish your redevelopment agency based upon certain requirements. So we're trying to keep you within those requirements the best that we can. There's no guarantee. There is no, you know, there are no, other than the rules as outlined in the code, which is we have talked, they are ambiguous and many terms are not defined. We've given you the best program we believe that comports with the requirements of the law. And if you go to a different project area, if you make it bigger, which is certainly up to your discretion to do, you can do that, but we believe that the chance of being challenged is somewhat greater. I can't say how much greater. I don't know what the political relationship is between the city and the county administrative office, for instance. I don't know if your supervisor would stand strongly behind creating the project area in the city of Morro Bay. I don't know those things at this point. We would work through those. This is a feasibility study. You can modify the boundaries. There is nothing legal here. So you can do what you choose. This is our findings.
Okay, one more question. You've got the corner of Main Street and Beach, which is an empty lot. Used to have a building there, has chain link fence around it now as zero blight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how's that figure?
I don't know. This was. We did our field analysis 4 months ago. I don't know what the circumstance was at that point in time.
But an empty lot can be a zero blight when it's...
A vacant lot is not... There's no physical blight there. It might be economic blight.
Well, but this has a chain link fence around it and everything, so that's still
not
paved,
necessarily, no.
Weeds, and it's still no blight.
Well, okay. It may not be.
I'm trying to understand. I'm not questioning. I'm just trying to understand.
It may have various blight indicators, but it would not show up as red. It wouldn't show up as pink, probably.
It showed up as zero. It showed up as blue.
It may show up as blue.
Okay. Any other questions from council? Okay.
Next slide. Here we go, Maggie.
We wanted to go over the inclusion back up and get into how that's calculated. The State Board of Equalization actually determines the value of property such as this, the power plants. It's not done by the county assessor. So every year the State Board goes through various records. This does not apply to Prop 13. This does not have an automatic 2% inflator attached to it. They use more of a classic assessor approach that an appraiser might use. Sometimes they'll use an income approach. But in general, power plants that have not had any new income or new investment or have not transferred ownership in quite some time generally decline. And we've seen that in other project areas as well. So to put it in at the beginning of a project area has caused some concern, and we've had some discussions about that. We know, and I think we've had some discussion with staff that there's some hope that good things will happen here soon, but we just want the council to be aware that as of right now, as it sits, it will be declining in value at least for the next couple of years. So it may hinder your ability to generate tax increment in the first 4, 5, 6 years of this project, because it'll be going down, even if other areas are starting to go up. So at some point that'll cross, and I think where we've finally arrived at is it's probably easier to include it right now because of the blighted conditions. If there's some problem, if it's a huge drag on the increment, it can be taken out down the road. But I think that's kind of where we've arrived at this point. And that's, obviously more discussion on that point, but that's kind of what we're looking at.
Another special consideration was regards to the challenges have been facing the local fishing industry and how that might have an effect in terms of blight along the Embarcadero area and the harbor facilities. And we did meet with the port officials and discussed a number of factors, understanding what has been happening with the fishing industry and the decline, and primarily, as you already are well know, a lot due to increased regulation. And in the discussions, tried to identify conditions, again, that would be recognized under the CCRL as factors contributing to blight. We can apply some things such as lack of patronage of the moorings or the slips in the harbor as a factor contributing to that. The difficult challenge you have in regards to that factor, there's really a structural shortage of slips and moorings by the commercial activities or the ground leaseholders who control the buildings and then lease out to the retail tenants, but they're all effectively remain current, if not had problems on the payments in several years. And secondly to that is, while individual store owners may be lamenting either a drop or due to drop in tourist spending or whatnot, they can see over in the Embarcadero for that area that we surveyed was only about 4%, and significantly lower than the city overall. And also the challenges that it faced at the Port District in leasing some of the commercial fishing facilities, they have faced challenges in getting those leased. One had to do with the ice generating machine, and if finding appropriate lessor for that facility, they frankly did get that leased. So as you look at the conditions now, yes, it's evident they are facing challenges, challenge they face haven't manifested conditions that are recognized to be indicators of blight. So while we did look at that and we're prepared to include that, and in fact we found that, we just did not find that at this time. So that's what's happening with the harbor.
As part of the analysis, we've done some tax increment projections. A new redevelopment plan has the ability to collect tax increment over a 45-year period. Even though the project area activities are 30 years, the law actually allows you to collect increment to pay debt for an additional 15 years beyond the 30-year planning period. So a total of 45 years, you could potentially collect tax increment. Obviously, to project out that far takes into account a lot of variables, and we've done our best just to provide some examples of what could happen in the project area. The two things that we did look at was one set of projections with the power plant and one without. We've done a summary table here, and just in round numbers based on our projections, including the power plant would generate approximately $71.4 million of gross tax increment. We talked about some of the pass-throughs that have to go back to the affected taxing entities. That would take approximately $46 million. The estimated net then after that would be $25 million. And we've shown for the power plant facility as an estimate, for the first 5 years of the plan, the gamble that the first couple of years may not generate increment, but it will generate more over time. So that's really what we've shown with these two sets of numbers. There's pages and pages of numbers in your report. They're too small to put up on the screen, but if you have specific questions about that, we can talk about that later.
Okay, we're at the point here where we're going to talk about our conclusions and recommendations. First conclusion is that agency activation and creation of redevelopment project area appears to be technically and fiscally feasible in the city of Morro Bay. The second conclusion is that the concern of potential project area residents and business interest should be minimal based on our experience, similar circumstances. However, as we discussed earlier, most community concern would evolve around the agency's policy regarding eminent domain. Concern of affected taxing entities should be greatly reduced if the city moves to create a redevelopment project area based upon the strictest interpretation of the redevelopment law. Again, we believe that that's what we have created as a part of the feasibility study. And we believe that we could convince during consultations with affected taxing entities that that is the case. The City Council, acting as a redevelopment agency, if you activate your redevelopment agency, could certainly create a larger potential project area, as we have discussed, if conditions on the ground worsen. For instance, one of the things that we haven't looked at is the issue of foreclosures. We're working with a number of clients now who are looking to create redevelopment project areas based on incidents of foreclosure and incomplete subdivisions having been constructed. Or public sentiment and or local perception of needs suggest a larger area. As we have just discussed, you should be prepared to accept a greater degree of risk of challenge, especially given today's economic climate and the belief that all affected taxing entities would scrutinize this process very carefully. You could, of course, create a smaller potential project area. You could elect to leave the power plant out, put the power plant in. You could elect to remove any areas that we have recommended you include. That's certainly at your discretion. But the benefits would be diminished. Council, certainly you have a very knowledgeable city attorney. We have worked with redevelopment agencies, city councils that have not retained special counsel. But be advised that redevelopment law is a specialty, and they're all law firms that offer attorneys who specialize in the plan adoption process and implementation processes. So our recommendation would be to retain a special counsel in that regard. The next step would be to actually activate your redevelopment agency. You would do that principally by adopting an ordinance finding the need for redevelopment in the city of Morro Bay. You'd adopt bylaws and a couple other housekeeping items, but essentially the state has given you the authority to create a redevelopment agency after you do that. You would then designate a redevelopment survey area. We would recommend that you, at this point in time, adopt as your survey area the area of interest, or no less than the potential project area. That would give you a little bit more flexibility considering additional areas if you thought it was important to consider adding them at that point in time. You would then designate preliminary project area boundaries as the redevelopment agency working with the Planning Commission. The Planning Commission has the first action in that regard. You would then formulate projects and programs. You're accumulating tax increment dollars to implement projects and programs within the boundaries of the project area, and in some circumstances, you could expend those dollars outside the project area. And we already mentioned the fact you could do that with affordable housing monies. You could also do that with your general expenditure monies as well. You would then have to evaluate what we call parallel processes. There are a number of reports that have to be prepared by the agency and transferred to the City Council. In this case, means you're not the City of Los Angeles, it seems redundant, but that's the way the law is. But these documents, this feasibility study, in fact, has been prepared using the preliminary report as its model. So one of the reasons we have done that would be to make that particular part of this process a little bit easier. And if you chose to move forward sooner than later, that should reduce the cost of preparing your or adopting a redevelopment plan. You'll, of course, have environmental review. Redevelopment projects fall under the purview of CEQA because they are defined as a project. Joint public hearing. The City Council then would choose to adopt the plan and the required findings by city ordinance. I believe that concludes our summary of how to move forward. And somebody threw in some sound effects. Discussion.
Scary.
Good timing. Thank you very much. It's a little bit before 6, so what I'm going to suggest we do now is take a short break, come back, and then I think we'll start with public comment and get some questions from them, and then we can ask those along with our own questions. Does that sound good to council? Okay, we will do that then. We'll take a short break and then come back and have public comment. Convene our meeting. This is a special City Council meeting, if you just tuned in at 6 o'clock, on the feasibility study for a redevelopment agency for Morro Bay. We had public comment at 4 o'clock, then we had a presentation, which if you missed it, will be shown again on AGP. And now we're going to have public comment again. So now's the time, you know, if you've had questions through the presentation and everything, please give them to us now, and then we'll add them to our question list, and we'll get everybody's answers, hopefully, by the end of the evening. Okay? Unless, Bruce, was there anything else you wanted to say first? Or go ahead with that. Okay. So we'll open public comment once again. And again, this is just on this topic of redevelopment. Anybody wish to speak or ask questions? Come forward to the mic.
If you could please sign in as well.
Yeah, I guess we do have to have sign in this time as well as introducing
my
yourself.
My name is Carol McGugan. I live in Morro Bay. I was looking at the map. I own a house on Reno Court, which is in the area of interest. It's off of Bonita. It's a small cul-de-sac. However, I'm blue-lined all around me. How would this affect me, whether it would be advantageous to be included or to stay as an area of interest if I would be affected?
Okay, we will ask that question.
And also my second question is, where could we see a map that actually has the red noted, the 20-point blight area noted on it?
Is one of our exhibits have that? I think it does.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Anyone else?
Monique Nelson from Morro Bay, and I think that this was a really informative meeting, and I think the owner's responsibilities and how would they work? Is this imposed on the property owner? Is it a voluntary thing by the property owner? What kind of improvements are anticipated? So that I think you could easily have another workshop, and as informative as this has been, and you know, there's a lot of material to absorb, but it would be helpful to have another workshop where it's really more of an opportunity for the public to ask questions and answers freely of the consultants. So I would suggest that. And there are a lot of questions, like, for instance, you know, how is the power of eminent domain for a city different in a redevelopment area versus under normal circumstances? So the other thing is, If it's a blighted area, just a comment, a lot of North Morro Bay, which would be affected by the redevelopment area, has a lot of high-density, affordable, low-income housing. So how would you do that? Even in our poorest sections, the property values are probably $400,000 or more. So how do you do that? How do you compensate them? How do you improve the property, or do you relocate them? And I could go on, but thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I began it knowing nothing, and Christine helped me a whole lot at the break there to understand a little bit. But I think out in public, people are probably confused to understand what's going on. I mean, we hear about we can generate this much money from, you know, diverting taxes, and it was explained to me pretty nicely over there, but it wasn't really done at the workshop. And you know, as a workshop, I would have liked to ask this question earlier on so that the rest of this would have made sense as we came on. So, you know, workshops are important to understand what's going on, and I would ask the question again, you know, what is the city, what are we the people getting for this? Now I kind of understand how it's going to work, that, you know, after the baseline, 2% of our taxes are going to be diverted that we collect into a fund, this fund of, I guess, elected people. So we're going to have another bureaucracy holding on to this money that, you know, I'm not sure of the laws of how it gets distributed in the general fund and things like that. So I would imagine that other citizens such as myself would love to understand, could use a redevelopment thing. And this could be a really good idea, but I think people need to understand that, you know, we're not going to be taxed 2% because, like I say, I came in at ground zero today with all these ideas that could happen, and not a whole lot of them have been resolved as far as, you know, we hear 2% tax. The average person probably thinks we're going to raise the taxes 2%. So, you know, I hope that we get have an effort of doing a better workshop so people at least can watch it on TV. But, you know, it's a iffy thing, and I don't know what we have to lose. I didn't hear that side of it because, you know, it seems to me that watching real estate values for the last umpteen years that we kind of hit that bubble just like everybody else, and we've come down. And what's our baseline year? Is it this year? Is it last year? You know, and whatever year it is, there's a lot of inflation built into it. So, you know, I don't know that you can anticipate a lot of money down the road until prices caught back up. It took 6 years the last time it went down to catch up. So why jump into something that's going to cost us money and not be able to support itself, if that is an issue? Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, my name is Rick Moore. I am just a vacationer here, but to me, Morro Bay is a California paradise, and I just don't want you guys to mess it up too badly.
Thank you. We'll try not to. Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to the council, and we've got some good questions here. First of all, I just want to reassure the public again, this is only the very first meeting on this topic. We're going to have numerous ones to follow, public hearings, all of them. We will make as much information as possible available. And you can always, Mr. Ambo is pretty good at this redevelopment stuff. So if you have questions about the basics on it, please call him. He's able to answer most of those kind of questions. So that's for our general public group.
Madam Mayor?
Yes.
Just to follow up on that, it's my understanding that we were going to go right to a vote on July 13th. So when you talk about multiple workshops, what are you referring to?
I'm not sure what the project, the process is for the vote.
Well, Madam Mayor, what we were recommending is that you continue the matter for further consideration, open up a hearing, activating the agency. As John identified, there's a process that has numerous steps in it that have state mandated. It's a public process of forming the agency. If we go forward, there'll be other places for public involvement and participation that are mandated and we'll embark on. We could also, though, if people still, even after we provided the answers to these questions, if people still have different questions or more, we can still do more, you know, workshops until council and community is comfortable, because these are good questions. We've got very good answers to them, and that's the beauty of this. There's really they've underscored the potential downsides, which are to the taxing entities. There's really no impact or requirement for any participation of an owner, unless we do a project together, and those are owner participation agreements, disposition development agreements, different things set up in the operation of agencies. But it's really whatever the council's comfort level is.
So what decision would you be looking for in July?
We would like to see if as John indicated, it's going to take 12 to 14 months to complete this next process of actually adopting a redevelopment plan and doing the necessary consultations and so forth. So we would need, they would begin that analysis, and they've got, as you can see, quite a foot up on that analysis, and they've already completed that in terms of the blight analysis. And then we'd open up the hearings. As he indicated, we need to form the preliminary project area, and John indicated starting with the area of interest, and then having further discussions on configuring what the boundaries would be.
So the vote that you would look for in July is, yes, we want to proceed with the process.
Yes, you want to
not
begin.
Not to say, okay, this is the area, this is what we're going to do right now. This is just the beginning of the process.
They have, at this point, they've pretty much satisfied their requirement to conduct the feasibility study. Okay. The next stage is really whether we want to begin the formal formation process or if we want to discuss more, have more discussions about whether we want to begin the formal formation process.
So within that discussion in July, we could say, okay, yes, we do, and we would like this schedule of public hearings in order to get the information arranged, right? Okay.
Again, we're trying to hit, if we want to hit the 2010-2011 base year as our base year.
Can we opt out?
Once we begin the formal formation process?
Uh-huh.
I suppose we could, but at that point, we will have been committed to it. I suppose we could.
Well, I guess it's cart before the horse. I'm not understanding, and I think this is the same thing Betty's asking. Okay, so we have this suggested area. It may not be the one that the council wants. So if we say, yes, we want to proceed with this in July, will we then have public hearings at which to discuss that and what we want to include and
absolutely
what we don't want to include?
Absolutely.
So it's just starting the process.
Yeah, the initial step is formulating.
But it is saying, yes, we want to do a redevelopment agency.
Right. The basic question is, do you want to pursue with a redevelopment agency?
So that's the question we'd have in July.
And then as John indicated, you're the ones that adopt your project area. And he's given you what he feels is the least risk.
Right.
And we can adopt any project area and have that discussion with the community within the formal formation process.
Does that answer your question, Betty?
Well, yes, because the way I was interpreting your comment was that we would be having multiple workshops before July 13th so the public could have input on whether or not we even want to go this route. And so we're not going to be having any more workshops on whether we want to go this route until the public hearing on the 13th. And I think that's what needs to be clarified, that this is, it's a do or die time in July 13th.
Well, but it's certainly something that people, you know, if they do have comments, having seen this on TV or whatever, we got two more meetings, they can certainly come to the council and let us know your feelings and public comment.
And my other concern was whether or not particularly the businesses that are involved in these areas have been contacted and even know if we're thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they know that.
Well, Madam Mayor, they will be. If we begin the formal formation process, we'll notify every property owner within the area.
I guess if I can interpret her concern is that if the businesses don't want us to do this, we'd rather know that before we agree to go ahead instead of after. So
I think we could do whatever the council would like. It just we're not going to be able to hit that base here. That means whenever we get out of this is when.
But even between now and then, we could make sure that the businesses all know, okay, here's
absolutely
the level that's suggested.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Great. Absolutely.
I have a question. Earlier you were talking about things that qualify or quantify for redevelopment. And you were stating factors such as bad streets and gutters.
And or other funds you have available to improve infrastructure deficiencies. It's just not, you cannot use those as the primary basis to create a project area. But the law does acknowledge they exist and does say that a blighted area may include those characteristics as a secondary factor.
Okay, so, but does the redevelopment have to impact that, or can it just be used strictly as an improvement for the existing?
You as the business people, the agency board, based on consideration, staff concerns, staff analysis, input from the community, the planning commission, you decide the priorities of your expenditures and where your money goes. So you establish, and you would work as a part of this process to establish a basic program and project expenditures list based upon the projected cash flow through tax increment for the 45-year period of time. And we understand that it's very hard to make those kinds of projections, especially with something like this power plant facility. And I think we've made a comment there that, you know, the increment projections we've given you are very conservative, but that we would not recommend you pursue something more aggressive until you know more facts on the ground with respect to the power plant in particular. We would be very happy. Doug is an expert at looking at the analyses, and Alonzo, with respect to what kind of benefit to the agency might accrue with development of vacant parcels in a project area. So if you had a fairly substantial piece of vacant ground and you knew of a development project that may happen within the next number of years, we could program the increment projections to include that and find out how much additional increment that might bring in for the agency.
Okay, and one last question. Regarding power plant. So we talked about contamination earlier, and so for the power plant to be involved in a redevelopment project, that would apply to them also?
It would. Right now, it's certainly a benefit from a blight perspective, because not only is it functionally obsolete, but it has hazardous materials have been identified on site. And again, that's both of those are immediate blight indicators per the code. So you notice there's a big red band around that property for those reasons.
Okay, and let me give you a hypothetical then. Let's just say that there's some contaminated.
Acted in 1990, that's the provision that now gives the agencies a certain authority and protection from liability. But if that plant was included in the project area, the agency would have certain authority to regulate and mandate certain cleanup activities. Now, given the scale of that particular project, and much easier to pursue that, say, if it's a gas station that has been abandoned, you know, that kind of a circumstance. So, I mean, the authority is there. I would suggest that you, if that was an issue, that you talk to legal counsel who is expert and remediation of brownfield situations and the redevelopment laws that pertains to that.
Thank you.
Okay. Before we go to the rest of the council, I'd like to get to the ones that the public asked and get responses to those first. Did you write down all the questions, or do you want me to repeat them for you?
Okay. Somebody did. We made an effort.
Okay. If you could respond to those, I'll just give you free rein to do that.
You want to, like, read them out? And,
Excuse me if I misspelled the name. Carol Guggen was basically had a property that was in the.
The first comment was raised by Carol Guggen, if I have that name correct, that owned a home in the area of interest surrounded by parcels designated in blue, and had a question regarding the advantage or disadvantage of her property being included in the RDA project area, whatever one may be created.
I'll take a stab at that. I think from the resident's perspective, there is no disadvantage from being included in a redevelopment project area. I mean, I'm saying that being completely objective. And by the way, I wanted to tell the council, we want to be extremely objective. Both of our firms have a lot of work. There was a lot of interest in redevelopment currently. There has been a lot of interest in redevelopment in the past, and there's going to be a lot of interest in redevelopment in the future. So we don't want to push you in any direction that you don't want to be pushed, either as a decision-making body or as a community. So our opinions here are extremely objective. So I outlined for you what I believed, what our firms believe to be the issue for the community, and that is eminent domain. That is the big issue. That's the 800-pound gorilla. If you take that off the table, one way or the other, I think most of the issues with respect to the community are taken care of. There's nothing but benefit. As this agency accumulates additional funds to put back into the community, there's nothing but positive benefit. There is no increase in their property tax rates. Now, it's not to say that as improvements accrue in the project area through both the
more. I see it as a net benefit. As a property owner, I'd prefer to live in a redevelopment area because there's full-time emphasis on economic development and an emphasis placed on maintaining and increasing property values. And the other advantage that the residential properties have is they have access, actually affordable households have access to the programs and the resources of the agency. And as you know, 20% of that money needs to be set on affordable affordable housing programs. So they have access to that where they didn't have access to that before, so that we can participate in those programs, rehab programs for affordable households and so forth, elimination of blight, street repairs, all of those things. We could spend money in those areas, even though that's not justification for blight.
Yeah, and I think, too, people are afraid of a big stick. This redevelopment agency got a big stick going to come out and force us to do this, this, or that. I can't say what the policy here would be, but I could probably say that 99% of the agencies we work with is that there is no stick. All programs and projects are voluntary. Regardless of how much money comes in through this redevelopment program, it will never be enough to do everything the city wants to do. It will be a supplement. So you as a decision-making body and business people will make the decision to allocate the available dollars to those programs and projects that are absolutely most essential to making the improvements that you think to be needed. So I don't think the people in the community should be concerned that, you've got a code enforcement department, and that's how you deal with those kinds of issues. It's probably underfunded, so it's more reactionary than proactionary or proactive. That's with respect to the stick. I don't think there will be one.
I can add to that. In the past, redevelopment agencies have funded code enforcement, more proactive code enforcement, and that relates across business license monitoring, too. So there are a number of resources and tools that are brought to bear with the agency in the project area that just we don't have the resources for in other parts of the community.
And again, forgive me if I get these names. Monique Nelson, I believe, was the person speaking second. And basically, the question is directed to next steps. Further elaboration, how would a redevelopment agency if it's created, and the property owners work together in either forming the project area?
I'll start there. On as far as eminent domain and residential properties, I'm going to go out on a limb and say we would never do that. Does anybody on this council think that we would do that? Eminent domain on residential property.
But it's not about this council. It's for the next 45 years.
Well, okay. But that's one of the things that we get to say happens or doesn't happen at the beginning. That's one of the things we set what we're going to use it for. And we have those three options, that we can use it on anything, that we can use it just on business, or that we don't use it at all. So those are the options that we would have.
The presiding council will have the option of making that decision at the creation.
And
of
is
the
that holding for the whole of well, the
development
agency? Well,
no, you could
agency?
Amend the project area, if I'm correct, to include eminent domain authority sometime during that 45 life cycle, which is the reason it's not necessarily limited to the council that sits here now.
Okay, so it could change.
So 20 years from now, somebody decide, hey, we want to instill that authority. If it is, as I'm understanding, I haven't gone through the process of the business itself, is that the condemnation requires remuneration of the condemned property according to fair market value. Now, clearly, if somebody in town were condemned in 2006, they're getting a lot more fair market value for that process than they would be in 2009, because as we all have suffered a decline in property value, I don't think anybody's been able to escape that. So that is the friction that surrounds that is what is fair market value. And generally, it's supposed to be done by independent appraisal methods to determine what that fair market value is. And so that's generally the process involved in there. So it's not a taking without remuneration. I think it's believed the same thing with the city. However, the latitude, the basis in which the property can be taken is broader than for a municipality. If the city has the police authority come and take property, but that has to be done for primary public improvements benefit to all, whereas this may be related to a project that is consistent with the redevelopment program objective, but not necessarily limited to public infrastructure improvements, the classic roadway widening type of project. So.
Yeah, I think the big difference between the authority you have as a city council or any other form of government has to exercise eminent domain is that you as a redevelopment agency could take a property and transfer that to another private individual or for private development.
And that's how it happened in the business my business is we did a feasibility study for...
...are fairly low. There haven't been a lot of improvements to the site. And therefore, the rents or the value of that property is low and affordable or somewhat affordable for the coast. So as redevelopment occurs, property values go up. How do we address the issue of potentially... I guess you'd say economic cleansing is what some people may call that, because those that are potentially forced out of their rental or their property because they can't afford it any longer. How do we address that and make sure that we're not just creating a 20% affordable housing quotient on one hand, but at the same time we're displacing people on the other? So it's kind of either a status quo situation or, at worst case scenario, more people are being displaced than are finding an affordable opportunity. I think that speaks a bit to the question that was raised.
It sounds like you're bringing up an issue oftentimes referred to as a gentrification.
Yes.
Okay. And I'm not as versed on how the redevelopment structure is for responding to that and the housing element. But I know the aspect of the affordable housing is not simply limited to the creation of new homes. It sometimes is to the rehabilitation of existing stock so that that stock is not lost as an affordable venue, as an affordable option. And then there's funding mechanisms that for the property owner, the landlord, to undertake improvements, but once they participate in that funding, they have to provide assurances that they provide the property within certain standards. It's not a stick approach, however. I think it is a voluntary participation in that type of program.
Well, Madam Mayor, if I can jump in, there are relocation benefits that are afforded to any properties that are required, and we're required to submit annual reports on the status for our affordable housing And the idea is that we're not supposed to lose. The idea is we're supposed to go in the other direction and increase. And so it's structurally difficult to eliminate affordable housing, and you've got to compensate and provide relocation benefits and find suitable housing, and you're under a more heavy burden to do that if you're in a redevelopment agency. And if you're not, and the redevelopment law provides more protections for those households than we do normally under our housing element, so there's it's stronger with redevelopment.
Project area that was zoned for residential units, he would have to make at least, or the agency would have to ensure that at least 15% of those units are affordable at the various affordability categories, from extremely low. Very low, moderate, and they're all based upon a percentage of the median income level here in San Luis Obispo County. Now, once those units are made affordable, they have to stay affordable for given periods of time. And I believe with respect to owner-occupied units, it's a 45-year time frame. And with respect to the rental units, it's a 55-year time frame. So I think the law has addressed those kinds of concerns that, whatever housing monies are spent in the project area are there for a very long time. Units built that are to be affordable are by agreement, are mandated to be affordable for those specific time frames. And there's a whole host of other requirements with respect to the housing issue. I mean, you could literally spend another workshop on these kinds of matters. But I think, if anything, the redevelopment law goes overboard with respect to affordable housing and how agencies are to use their dollars and the number of units that are to be constructed. And it can become a bookkeeping nightmare. And Doug works with redevelopment agencies to go through the numbers periodically. There are annual reports that have to be done. There's also an implementation plan that has to be created and on a five-year cycle. And a lot of that has to deal with affordable housing requirements and how you're comporting to the law. Are you building the number of units you're supposed to build? Are they restricted as they're supposed to be restricted? Are they occupied by the people who are supposed to be occupying them based on the income limits? And that kind of thing. So, again, the issue could go on and on. I hope we've addressed some of the concern.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to add a little bit to that. Generally speaking, redevelopment agencies are more protective of affordable housing, existing and inclusive, to provide more affordable housing. And in addition to that, we already have Christine sitting next to me. She already has a pretty aggressive program in place. So it's not like we'd be starting from zero. We'd be augmenting many of the programs we already participate in and supplementing those and leveraging those resources with one another to bring more housing provided to more housing opportunities provided to the community.
We need to have special protections for our mobile home parks because we have about 14, and some of them are included and some are not.
I don't know where the mobile home fits, but I believe the state regulates the mobile home park facilities, so there's some protections at the state level for the mobile home park facilities. And perhaps, Bruce, you could tell me whether or not they qualify as a habitable structure to be classified as affordable, or any improvements in the park itself would be place them under that category or not. I don't
In the simplest terms, we probably have more flexibility under our own redevelopment program to provide assistance to affordable mobile home residents. If we had an agency, then we did working through the federal programs that we're currently working through, because they have more restrictions. We can initiate, there's a whole host of programs that we can develop and customize to meet our residents' needs. And we've got a person that's very good at that. So I would say that we have more flexibility and can strategically target more of those needs with the agency than without it. I don't know if it particularly provides more protection because it is regulated through the state.
No, and the code does not provide additional protections for people, residents in mobile homes, but certainly they are afforded the same level of protection as any other resident with respect to dislocation and relocation efforts by the redevelopment agency if they are dislocated. And at this point, I simply because they are included in project area doesn't mean that there would be any dislocation of any of the residents. Probably would be more that you are looking to improve conditions in that particular mobile home park or surrounding infrastructure, roadways, that kind of thing.
So the reason some of them are in the project area and some are not is because you've evaluated them and some of them were seen as blighted and some were not.
Well, exactly. I mean, there's certainly no intention on our part to target specific mobile home parks simply because they're mobile home parks. We evaluated a number of mobile home parks, and I believe probably more were left out because we were quite impressed with the condition of a number of the mobile home parks.
Thank you.
I think one other question that she had was, how does the city and property partnership work? How does that begin? What are the steps involved? If you're in this redevelopment area, the money is going to be coming in. How does the property owner work with the city?
And look at the project as proposed, and make recommendation to the council based on the merits of the project. I mean, look at the project performer, depending on what kind of a project it is. Let's say it's a piece of vacant land. Bruce will look at the numbers. We'll look at the requirements of law with respect to expenditure of tax increment dollars on that particular kind of a project. And a recommendation will be made to the agency board as to whether or not you should participate. If it's somebody who has a home in the project area and they're looking for agency assistance in, say, putting a new roof on, certainly the agency could do that through their LMI fund. And that's what that's all about. You could have a grant program, or you could have a program where you would loan money at below market rate interest rates, and you could structure that program any way, or those programs any way you choose. I think, Bruce, with respect to implementation, maybe you want to carry that on a little bit more.
Andrew just reminded me, the agency board is the city council. So, I mean, you're two. Normally, almost the majority of overwhelming cases, the city council acts as the agency board, and the mayor is the chairperson, and the existing staff just functions that way. Finance and city manager, and all the rest of the support staff still functions the same way in that role. John, I forgot where I was.
Well, we were talking about implementation.
Working together.
Madam Mayor, one of the things I might remind you, we had a request for assistance not too long ago from that project where they developed workforce housing. And that would have normally been something that we would have probably, we funded it because we have an inclusionary housing program by operation in our code. But normally that would have been something that the agency was involved with. And actually, Urban Futures did the pro forma financial analysis that justified the expenditure and assistance to make that project go forward with that workforce housing at the Seashell project over off the freeway, the retirement home project where they're building workforce housing. That's an example of participation with property owners.
I just had a quick follow-up question to Bruce, I guess, about administration of the program, if we go that way. And what do you forecast as the projected burden for staff time and effort? And do you foresee actually
about working within our existing resources? And it would just be more things we'd have to do. And obviously, we move this along because it's a city council priority, and it's a revenue-generating activity. And that's why we've identified it. And we've kind of... That's why we've moved, and we're recommending to move along these lines as and following your direction. So this is one of these things where, we would absorb it within the existing staff. I mean, we would probably add, I mean, as John indicated, we would need to get a special counsel. And that is strongly recommended. I mean, Rob is great at everything, but Rob and special counsel would work closely on some of those things. But that would be not permanent staff, just, you know.
On an as-needed basis during the formation period. During the formation period only?
They would be around. It would be helpful to have them around, especially if we had a big project where they're asking for participation. For example, a conference center or something, and they asked for agency assistance. And especially if we got into a situation where we were bonding and we were getting into committing the agency to a lot of resources, we'd want to get more input.
Okay, I think that actually covered David's question. As far as who the governing body was, did that cover it? Okay. All right, so now we're to council questions. Carla, you haven't said anything? You got anything?
Oh, I'm waiting.
Well, go. Your turn.
Well, I don't... Get it over here. I don't know if my questions are going to be to them. I just have a couple questions right now because I'm getting all mine answered. But you mentioned earlier about the ERAF, the money. I want to talk about the money. And I was just at a seminar, and it just very, very, two seconds talked about the ERAF, which I will say what it is just so they know, is the Education Revenue Augmentation Fund that RDA pays into, correct?
Yes.
And that the state has been raiding that. And yes, the court prevailed and RDA got it back, but apparently it's going to be fair game again for these funds again. Is that my understanding?
We just got an email yesterday from our state California Redevelopment Association that keeps track of all this, and they probably will try. It may change tomorrow. We'll probably get a different proposal tomorrow. So it's something that's evolving right now.
So I guess my question then, being new to this, is what kind of effect would this have on us if, in fact, the state does this and we move into this forward on a redevelopment? How would this affect
the effect on a new project area would be negligible because they take a percentage of tax increment. If you're only getting 10, 20, 50, 100,000 for the first couple of years, they're taking 2 or 3%. They realize that most agencies, some agencies are getting over $1 million a year in tax increment. They've already obligated most of that to bond debt, to housing projects. So the state is mindful that there are bondholders involved. There's other people, that have commitments. And so they're only taking a small percentage. So then to talk about when your initial tax increment is rolling in, the state, in fact, does a 2-year look back to determine your increment that they're going to take a percentage of. So there's a two-year head start you'd get right away. You wouldn't even fall into their net for a couple of years. And then once you do, it'd be a very small percentage.
And from what I heard when I was at this seminar, they've been doing this since 1992, raiding the funds? Is that or somewhere about that?
Yeah, and anytime the state seems to have budget troubles, they go through this process, and ERAF has been a mechanism that they've used to help themselves to a portion of RDA monies.
Okay. And then my next question is about the startup funds for starting up the RDA. The money, I guess, that is in our staff report, and I don't know if this goes to Bruce or to you, the next step of the money that we would apply for the grants and things to move on to the next level, is that then only to fund the next step of this, or is that what we need? Is there startup money required to actually fund and start up our RDA beyond this next $160,000?
There may be, but it's I kind of liken it to taking money from one pocket and putting it in the other, in the sense that we're not adding new staff. The staff would be, those duties would be absorbed within the existing staff. It'd be a modest program. At the early stages, we're going to have a lot of money and resources. And we would still continue. We still have low to moderate income money in the low to moderate income housing fund. But what it would do is reallocate staff time to place full-time emphasis on economic development. So in the any time is what's been happening statewide with redevelopment agencies is with the we've been leveraged. Agencies have generally leveraged for $1 of public expenditures, $7 of private investment. So it's not just a dollar that we're spending; it's money that comes around through the community. And they're saying in a recent study that I've just read that was published by or referenced by the California Redevelopment Association is that. So it's generally we're leveraging $1 of public investment to $7 of private investment, and they're saying that goes around the community twice through insulated services when it hits the road in the community. So it's in a ballpark we're averaging $1 of public investment, it's leveraging $14 because it goes twice through the community of private investment. So we're seeing the benefits just aren't localized to these programs. They're throwing off benefits to the community in general, not just in these jurisdictional boundaries within the project area.
Okay, Betty?
Yes, if I could just piggyback off of Ms. Borchardt's comment. Mr. Ambo, the $160,000 is an upfront cost, or is that a cost that expands the next 12 to 14 months? And would that include the attorney?
That does not include the attorney. It would just include an estimate of what it would be to guide us through the formal formation process.
So there's no upfront deposit, $200,000, and you start the process?
No. It would just be like we did the redevelopment feasibility study the same way. But we could apply for, and actually Christine and I are trying to set a date with the community development block grant folks to apply for two more grants. Mm-hmm. So we have a potential to get $70,000. And then next cycle we would apply again. And then we still have revenues from past CDBG loan repayments to cover that if we needed to.
Thank you. May I continue? I have a question about the amount of money that you conservatively estimated that we would make over the time. And I figured it, if I did it correctly annually, it was anywhere from $250,000 to $750,000. I think it was $246,000 to $333,000. If you break down the amount that you suggested that would come over time once you eliminate the pass-through money. It's kind of towards the front. Do you need a page number?
Do you have the spreadsheets? They're in the...
And it seems to me if we kind of force their hand, then the cycle that you're predicting of them going down would have to bottom out. Some of us believe they've already bottomed out and they can't get much lower. But maybe it would start the cycle back up sooner. And I don't know if you have any response to that. And we, the council, were presented with one potential option that they're looking at to do that. May be pie in the sky, it may be a reality. But I guess my question is, any feedback on that kind of idea that if you push them to move ahead, that that could happen sooner, and that that might be more of a less of a delay in terms of including them or seeing a positive input from them as being still included in the development area.
Yeah, and again, we did a 45-year projection, and it's necessarily has a lot of assumptions. So, you know, who's to say whether our assumptions will come true or not? If something positive happens there sooner, then obviously the increment would grow sooner. You know, we've taken our best stab at it. I think our viewpoint was had to look at it as it sits right now, which is a declining asset that's being valued by the state as a power plant. The state doesn't come in and say, you know, someday this will be, you know, a property by the ocean worth hundreds of millions of dollars. They don't, that's not their mindset either, and not the way they value things. So in the short term, it's going to depreciate for a few more years. The sooner, you know, if the agency or city can actively help that along, then that would be a positive thing. And I think that's why in our discussions we kind of came around to thinking that because of the way that it's blighted as it sits, it's easier to put it in now, see what happens. Hopefully it'll be positive. Worst case, if nothing ever happens there and it keeps going down and draining your regular increment, it can actually be taken out. You can actually amend it out. It would be easier to do that than to wait. Let's say you don't put it in. You adopt the project area and think, well, we'll wait till it really bottoms out and then put it in. Who's to know whether the law changes by then? So I think it's more of a risk to not do anything with it. I think it'd be easier to put it in, take it out later, and that was one of the options we mentioned.
Okay, thank you. I do have another question. If I can find it on my page. We talked about agency versus what the city would demand on, say, a particular developer. When those kinds of things happen, and since we're both the agency.
And units. The agency, an obligation is created on the part of the agency to provide 1.5 affordable units. They may or may not be in that project. It's an obligation. If it's the type of project that could handle that type of restriction, maybe it's something that you negotiate at that time with that developer. If not, it accumulates as an obligation that needs to be taken care of eventually, but maybe not on that site.
And would he also then be obligated under our housing element to have another inclusionary house, or he gets to choose, or...
Oh, you mean are we going to be able to double dip against the housing element?
Yeah, that's what I want to know.
Yeah, I really don't know. I'd give that to the
city attorney.
Yes, my guess is we could probably go to the more rigorous standard,
but probably not both.
Probably not.
Okay. Thank you,
Noah. Got anything?
I don't have any further questions at this point.
Okay, one question that was brought up in the very beginning. Did you look at the new futures report, and did you give that any weight in your review about the power plant?
In terms of
the potential other uses of the property?
I mean, we looked at that. The thing that surrounds the potential other use of the power plant, and as for purpose of this study, the current condition of the power plant is what's most relevant today. The potential future use of the power plant plays into the issue whether to include or exclude and what might happen. It's all highly speculative at this stage. You know, from where we stand, there's no definitive direction right now. There's possibilities abound, but no specific direction or commitment that we can see on in the record. There was that study you mentioned, the management study talked about
the new futures report.
Yeah. And we read through that and just took consideration all the options. Yeah, we read through all those documents in terms of what they identified as challenges and how the redevelopment program may be able to respond to that. So,
okay, I think they just wanted to know if that had been reviewed.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, that's partly fell under those special consideration, kind of that size supplemental analysis. A lot of that was in response to those the reports themselves.
Okay. I guess my question, did you have anything else, Rick?
I have one.
Okay, go.
I'm not sure how to phrase this, so bear with me. Let's take the analogy of you got two 10-year-old Chevys in your instances where it has hurt that area economically, and I'm thinking of Morro Bay Boulevard when I say this. If we go fixing up areas, making, and I know, I realize you can't say, okay, well, this area is, looks like blight now, so even though it might not meet the CCRL's definition of blight, it still looks like blight as compared to what we've just fixed up. So you have to go through the whole process all over again. And what's the reality of that? What's the success rate of trying to fix up an adjacent area that's been ignored?
Well, you know, I think that's probably a planning problem. I mean, that's one of the, you have a general plan in place, and you have policies and programs and procedures to implement the general plan. And I think as a part of your visioning processes and your planning process, you look to improving all areas of your community, and you want to use whatever tools are available to you to help you do that. Well, the redevelopment program, if you had one in place, would be one additional tool. By using it in some areas of your community, does it disadvantage other areas of the community? I don't know. I mean, if I build a shopping mall, does that impact the old downtown? Well, it's been proven that that certainly does happen because it draws retail traffic to the to the areas near the freeways, which is where malls usually are. One of the rare exceptions to that is San Luis Obispo. Well, that mall had very, very difficult times because the downtown is so vibrant. I suppose anything is possible. If you created a project area, and in the next 20 years, the area that's in the project area is doing so much better than it was, and you're now impacting other portions of the community, it would be possible to amend the redevelopment plan unless the state legislature has made it so difficult because they backfill schools. You could do that and then begin to improve that area. I think it's really hard for us to say that if by helping this part of the community, you're going to disadvantage that part of the community, because at least at that point, this point in time, other parts of this community are doing very well, or at least appear to be from an outsider's perspective. So I don't know. That's probably an in-house issue.
Madam Mayor, I have a little experience with that. Andrew just reminded me, but that does free up more general fund resources because we're spending less on an area, and that frees up more general fund resources. There is an advantage because you do have this emphasis on redevelopment. There is, it's kind of a mixed bag, but I do understand that there is, I've been in places where they've complained that, the redevelopment agency had all these resources. But, you know, through the life cycle of an agency, in the beginning years, you know, we were really pioneering in certain places. And then towards the end, when we had a robust increment in cash flow, then we were able to, then agencies had more resources and could do more things. But there were a lot of years where there was suffering and there was not much going on, and the trend had to be reversed.
I just add one more thing to that. I mean, a community is much like a chain, and the chain is only as strong as its weakest link. So to the extent that we have identified the weakest link in your community, if you could put funds, additional monies into that part of the community to help make it stronger, the overall chain is stronger. Your community is more strong. So I think overall it's definitely a positive thing from the perspective of the entire community.
If there's any insular property that Morro Bay Boulevard has over most traditional downtowns, it has to be the fact that it appeals to a renewing visitor population, as the Embarcadero does. So a lot of what makes Morro Bay Boulevard and Embarcadero click is people who come and visit Morro Bay as opposed to live here, even though people who live here spend money there as well. We do a lot of retail impact studies for just the issue you raised. Development A, displacing dollars from development, we quantify the impact, whether or not the stores are going to go out, whether it lead to deterioration. And what we found is when you challenge the original base, because you're chasing contemporary retail model, contemporary retail design layout, floor space requirements, you do put a burden on those original downtowns area when they previously represented the sole shopping option for community-driven expenditures. But that also has limited effect. And I always ask people in the tight metro areas, you know, so they're proposing another Walmart. And this district is already surrounded by three Kmarts, a Target, so-and-so. So what is the seventh, you know, big box retailer going to, how much further is that going to erode than has already been eroded by the previous six that have already gone in over the last 10 years? What you find is that retailing patronage of these districts, when you're surrounded, now you're not in that situation, but what happens is that erosion begins to diminish. The first one has the big is visitor driven. So,
okay, anything else? Question? I have one more question. There's restrictions on use of RDA funds outside of the project area, right? Is there information on that in here? Included in this?
I think we mentioned that you can use, if certain findings are made, you can use monies generated in the project area outside the project area. I think a good example of that is a linear infrastructure improvement. It's very hard to start and stop a sewer line, for instance, just within the boundaries of a project area, so the agency could make a findings that it's necessary for the improvement of the project area to extend the sewer line outside the limits of the project area and therefore spend money the agency has generated from within the project area on that project. So you can use monies, increment monies, generated from within the project area outside the project area in certain circumstances.
So like continuing infrastructure type things, but it's pretty restrictive is my understanding. That was part of what they touched on too.
I think it's based on the needs of the community and you as the city council and redevelopment agency making the findings that would have to be made. We have agencies using increment generated from a project area outside the project area frequently for those kinds of reasons.
Oh, because I mean, that was another thing they talked about was the Senate bill that was tightening up on a lot of the uses outside of the project area because of that.
It may well be, and that's not to say they're not abuses. I mean, there's abuses with everything.
I just didn't know how restrictive it was, but I guess infrastructure.
Right now, you can
sense.
Do that.
So, okay, thank you.
Actually, that speaks to a curiosity that I have. The question's been talked to, but really directly, how would the sewage treatment plant, it's not included, but how could that be affected by this outside of the obvious potential of increase of flow? Do we have the flexibility to utilize some of these funds to assist us with investment in the sewage treatment plant? I would like to confirm that as an option for us.
John, do you want to take that? In the simplest terms, yes. But we're not going to we're not going to have much of a revenue stream in the early stages. I mean, we're looking at coming online in year 8, and we're encumbering debt now. And maybe Susan can answer that, our finance director.
Coming online in year 8 is projected. We've recently got
7 ratio of public to private. And so we would want to see product in terms of increased assessed property values, and that has a negative. I mean, it's a public property. So I don't think it's doing anything for increment. Is that improved level of treatment service a priority for the agency? It may be. But there may be other things that we're trading off for it, like affordable housing opportunities, bricks and mortar product, and stimulating economic development. The key emphasis in these initial years of takeoff should be to get to grow that increment and make it go up as quickly as possible, and spending money on things that don't get directly at that may not be that high of a priority.
My goal was to just confirm, though, if the body decided that this was a goal for us, we would have that opportunity.
Absolutely. If it's in the project area, and
it is not in the project area.
Oh.
Even if it wasn't, I think based on the discussion, you could consider findings that it would be a benefit to the project area. So
because it's water and sewer.
Yeah. And by the way, Councilman, that, you know, we suggested you retain legal counsel, and you're really talking about an implementation issue here. But those are the kinds of issues that legal counsel would be very helpful in helping you to determine what would be the, at least from a legal perspective, because you have to look at it from a financial perspective.
Okay. If that's all the questions, what I was going to suggest is, because we don't have many public hearings, our meeting Monday night, perhaps we put this on as an additional public hearing so that it gives the community a little time to digest this, and we don't need a staff report or anything other than the one we already have, but have it for public comment, have it for us to discuss again, ask any questions that we think up between now and then. Is that okay with council? All right?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, let's do that, and that gives us another bite at the apple before we have to make a decision. Yes. I'm sorry? Okay. Okay. All right. Well, we'll just change the motion to a public hearing on the 22nd and 13th.
And I would like to, just for us to consider consulting some of the bodies that could be affected by this through the tax increment and really specifically the school district, because
from the get-go, I mean, they're going to want to get through the process and the negotiations and determine how they are made whole or close to whole during the process. So we certainly can reach out and tell them that we're thinking about this and to put in any comments, but I can tell you both the county and the school district are going to have many reservations. They're not going to come to your meeting and say, go do this, because their initial reaction is you're taking away part of their tax base.
So my curiosity is, where do we project them falling within these negotiations so we can have that that part of this process in mind and have a knowledge about what sort of a bite or adjustments we need to be prepared for and be able to make our decision based on that?
We can put that certainly on the early process, you know, track, if that's the goal, is to find out and get those negotiations done early.
And I could add to that, I think, and John, jump in here, I entirely agree with Rob. They're not going to say we support this. They're not that. We can pretty much promise you that. But the other point is that if we go through this, the basis, the where we'll end up is they'll have to challenge us in court, and that's where we're getting at this degree of risk that John's been trying to stress. They're not integrally tied as an approval body in the process. We're required to consult with them, and we're required to share the tax increment diversions with all the taxing entities and provide notice and everything else. But they're not a necessary step in the approval process. And in all honesty, there is a potential that their ox may get gored, and that's why Rob indicated that those and our Urban Futures has indicated they're potentially at a slight disadvantage. But I would also add, though, I have to say this, that it should be in their interest long term, if they're here presumably, and they're going to be here for the community, because at the end, at the sunset of the agency, they're going to get one heck. They're going to have an aggressive period of 30 to 45 years where we've been generating increased increment. And when the agency sunsets, that's going to flow through to the district, all the taxing entities. So they're going to reap the benefits of those 45 years of intense focus on economic development and inflated property assessments, and that'll flow through at that period of time. And as John indicated, there are other arrangements that we may be able
to. Yes. Well, we don't like what you're doing, so we're going to challenge you in court, or we suggest you modify the boundaries of your potential project area, which would be to diminish its size. Well, we've given you reasons to believe that, you know, the scope of the project area has already been highly refined. I don't know from sitting here what the county would suggest you take out at this point. But that's really the only thing they would have as a basis to negotiate with you, is the threat of going to court if you don't modify the boundaries of your project area. Now, what we have found effective in dealing with counties, because they are going to be providing some amount of funds to your project, is that you might sit down with them and negotiate a project that is of mutual benefit to both the community and the county, and you both share. So therefore, you know, an amount of the tax increment they are generating, or if it's the school district or whoever, you might negotiate some sort of a mutually beneficial project as a way of offsetting the loss of tax dollars to that entity.
Can I ask would you clarify for me? I assume that some of the pass-through monies is like a little payoff to the school district and the county. Is that erroneous?
Mitigation might be a better No, the law is set up so that most taxing entities get about a third of their share back over the life of the plan. In this county and in this city, your school districts are characterized as basic aid districts. They actually get about two-thirds of their share directly back from the pass-through. So we're really only talking about what's the remaining third going to be. And in some cases, the state, you know, may even make up some of that. We need to get into that and look at each district. But I do know that because of the basic aid situation, the school districts here are a lot better off than they are in most RDAs.
Thank you.
You know, another question that I've been thinking about is based mostly on our general plan and its limbo status at the Coastal Commission. And I see really the preservation of our history and our character as a real key goal to this redevelopment and the process. And obviously, it would be dependent on the general plan. So how does that interact if we go into this with a general plan that isn't quite formulated, and that is a really strong concern for the community? How do we confirm that we can handle those issues and be responsible with it?
That's a good question and comment to raise. We would need to key to Morro Bayway. I mean, we just need to guide development and do it the way that your board wants to do redevelopment, and you would be the agency, and that's, yeah, so it's whatever you would approve. And
I understand that and appreciate that. I'm thinking about overall that the key component is the public and the community buy-in, and for ways for us to draw that out and really get that trust and support for this. That's just a general thought I want to put out there to make sure that we're doing everything we can. So, as you've pointed out, we're efficient with this, and it's a positive thing that the community can be really proud of on a large scale.
Madam Mayor, I'd like to add, it's good that we've answered these questions, and I mean, the more of them that come on, I think brings an opportunity to educate the community. And we recognize that in the process. And when we began the formal formation process, that's also part and parcel of the whole process.
With that idea of engaging the community, and especially the business community, I know we can do a blast to the chamber, but can we put an announcement that we're going to have public hearings on this at both June 20th? Well, it's too late for that. At our July 13th
Absolutely.
Meeting in the water bill so that we do...
If we can get it ready in time, we would have to have it the first week of July in order to do that.
So I think we could do that.
Flyer in time.
Yeah, it won't make it for this meeting, but it will for that.
We could do that. And we might even do like a fact sheet or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that would be helpful so that, you know, the more information is out there, the less scary it's going to be. Because I think people have some preconceived notions about, oh my gosh, eminent domain and this, that, and the other thing.
Yep.
And we need to get the proper information out so they can participate in the discussion. Is there something over here you wanted to talk about? Okay. All right. All right. Then I'd entertain a motion that we continue this to our June 22nd meeting.
Second.
And get a notice out to the public in the water bill about the July 13th meeting.
Second.
Okay. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you, gentlemen.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.